Hello.
Hey, you made
Hi.
it.
You guys are so patient. Thank you. This is what happens to me on a Sunday morning.
I was talking about the cinematographer of Wild, Katie.
Oh, okay.
I just talked to him yesterday, so I was like, what was the hardest scene to shoot? And I thought it was going to be some, crazy, like the cliff sequence or whatever. And he was just like, oh, the scene in the shower with Reese. He was like, because you have to be very close to them. And it was, I wanted to preserve her modesty, but it was just her and I in the shower. And so I took off my glasses so that everything would be blurry.
That's what you want in a cinematographer.
I wonder if he told the director or if he just like went through it and then afterwards like, oh yeah, I couldn't see a thing. Don't worry about it.
Anyway, it was funny. Okay, welcome back, everyone.
Yay, welcome back.
Hi.
It's been forever, it seems like.
I know, it really does.
The festival season separated all of us on different.
I've had people actually clamoring for us to return, so there is a groundswell out there somewhere.
It is. So, in case you've forgotten who we all are, I'm Nathaniel from the Film Experience, and I'm here with Katie Rich from Vanity Fair,
Hello.
Joe Reed from The Atlantic,
Hi, everyone.
and Nick Davis, fresh from the jury of the Chicago Film Festival.
Hello.
So, what did you award?
Well, I should stipulate I was on only the jury for the LGBT part of it. So I was not Kathleen Turner's colleague in primary deliberations. I am
Oh.
sorry. But I did run into her like every day.
You are
Like,
in our hearts, though.
Tim Brayton and I were laughing about, like, is it possible to get bored of running into Kathleen Turner?
Oh.
It's just getting crazy. Like, it was just a daily occurrence, but she is funny. She was the gift that kept on giving.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
Just, she would walk into, I saw maybe like six or seven of the same screenings she did, and sometimes that was like a public screening with a whole, the theater sold out, and sometimes it was like 10 people. And she would walk in and kind of throw her coat, slightly Miranda Priestly style, over the bar onto the front seat, and she would go, I don't need anything. I'm just going to go to the bathroom, and then I'll just be right back. It's like, wow, nobody asked if you needed anything. Okay. But she was super nice to talk to, and their choices were awesome. The best movie was The President by Mohsen Mahmoudov, who's this super awesome Iranian director who's been around for a while, and I think it would definitely get a foreign nomination if it were.
Submitted.
Anton Yelchin and Geraldine Chaplin were our actor and actress, and they're together at last.
Yeah, finally.
People have been, speaking of clamoring for reunions.
Yeah.
So what did, but what did your LGBT jury choose?
The one that we chose for the top prize was called Xenia, which was sort of a Greek camp take on the Odyssey between the straight and gay brothers who are Albanian and trying not to have people find that out in Greece while they look for their father. And this super intense sort of head-on style Swedish movie called Something Must Break, about a trans character whose identification isn't really that clear at all, and a seemingly straight guy who is in love-hate with him.
We realize we haven't done a podcast in a while, and we have not seen the same things except for I believe we've all seen Whiplash and Gone Girl. Even Birdman, not all of us have seen. Let's start by the order they opened, Gone Girl.
Right, Gone Girl.
And it has been quite discussed.
Yeah.
But speaking of discussion, Nick, you're the impromptu star of this podcast, I guess, because you got the first question and the second one.
What do you mean, this podcast?
But you recently taught a class about that, right?
I did. There's this awesome group of 29 women in their 50s and 60s mostly in Chicago who wanted a facilitator for a monthly film group, and I got the gig. And so, yeah, we just talked about it for 2 hours the other day.
So
Man.
had a lot of them read the book beforehand?
Yeah, I would say maybe like half or two-thirds had read the book before.
Okay.
And there was, they were all over the map about loved the movie, hated the movie, somewhere in the middle.
Interesting. Well, that
2 hours
seems.
is longer than the movie. That is fascinating.
It's getting right up there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Out comes the rosé at 12 o'clock, and we go. Hey, Monday. Hey, ladies. This was our second one after Love is Strange. That was also kind of a funny double feature so far. Next month is Birdman, so yes, I will have seen it.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, they're picking all the Oscar contenders.
They make me pick the movie. They want to feel like they're in school. They told me they don't even want any input.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And you gave them two movies about marriage with vastly different ideas about what that means.
That's right. I thought we're all getting to know each other. Let's just see what comes out here.
Let's dig deep.
Yeah. It's like those Far From Heaven scenes where you're plying them with margaritas or something.
Yeah.
You're like, so tell me about your husband.
Well, you can imagine how awesome it was to talk about Love is Strange with, like, 29 people in their 50s and 60s. That was super cool. Gone Girl was super exciting to talk about, but maybe for different reasons.
Well,
they did not want to talk, a group of, an all-women's film group did not want to go near the question of whether the story or the author or the character is misogynist.
Wow.
That was not what they thought was interesting to discuss, which I thought was interesting.
So did you like it, Nick?
I liked it a little more the second time I saw it than the first. I'm still pretty in the middle about it, and I forget where all you guys are.
I liked it better the second time, too, and the fact that I wanted to see it a second time is a good sign, because I don't often race back to the theater.
Yeah.
But the more I think about it, the more I realize all of the things I really love about it are... lead me to believe that I need to read the book, that I just really... I love the structure of it, I love... anything I love about it, I'm thinking, comes from the screenplay and the book.
And see, I have read the book, and I thought the movie was a vast improvement on it.
Oh.
It kind of... I mean, it's hard to talk about it, because there's just, like, specific things that the book does that the movie gets rid of or changes around that I thought were a lot better, but... I thought in general being able to see performance as opposed to reading it written out, and I thought the performances are both really great, made a really big improvement in the story.
That's so funny. I think I'm the exact opposite.
I think a lot of people are.
I feel like the movie, much as I as a movie, as its own thing, I think it's really good. I'm a terrible person when it comes to this movie, where like I think less of it with people who really loved it, and I think better of it with people who really didn't love it. And I sort of always find myself sort of, like, arguing the opposite and trying to sort of, like, I guess bring it all to this, like, vast middle. I don't know.
Joe the diplomat.
Or, like, or just the argumentative a-hole. Like, I don't know.
You might be Socrates. You should find out.
But I feel like the one thing I'm definitely sort of, like, sure of with this is that, like, I think the adaptation and sort of the limitations of a movie where you really... have to funnel things through one character's sort of thoughts and words and actions limits what we know about the Amy character once we get past the middle of the movie. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Are we worried about spoilers here?
No.
Oh, I don't care about
that.
It's
been out long enough.
Okay,
I just think her perspective in the book is so much richer once we find out like what she's been up to and what she's been plotting and what the first half of that book was really like in reality. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah.
And I feel like we get like a monologue in the middle of the movie, that sort of like voiceover monologue where she's sort of reading full passages from the book, which is another thing I was sort of annoyed by in Inherent Vice, actually. It was just sort of like, I get that you really love this prose and don't want to get rid of it, but like, I'm not quite sure just actually having a narrator open up a page to the book and, like...
is the best narrative move,
the
yeah.
most elegant solution? Yeah.
I've got a movie for you called Cosmopolis. It is great.
But, yeah, I thought we lost something a little bit in from the Amy character. But by that same token, I talk to people who've never read the book who really find the Amy character incredibly fascinating. So... They obviously still did it, like, even with what I think is losing some big key components of that character.
Are you talking about the abbreviation of the, or at least that's what I've heard, the abbreviation of the cool girl monologue?
I don't think even necessarily that. I think they get that out. Like, they put that...
Yeah, I mean, line for line in there. It's, not the whole thing, but a lot of it.
It's more lived in the book because she sort of takes you back through all these stories that you heard in the first half, and in the case of the movie, like you've seen in the first half, and show you what she's really thinking, how she really experienced those things.
So it's more like a Rashomon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I was kind of willing to put the pieces together in that. Like, you know, I was kind of really on board with the movie early on. It kind of grabbed me in. And there was so much stuff with watching what Rosamund Pike does. Like, you know, what this very perfect thin blonde woman does when she is not trying to please a man anymore in this very, you know, sadistic way. When she gets this dumpy clothing and she eats a ton of crappy food and she has these great fish reactions when she finally meets up with Neil Patrick Harris. I thought there was so much of the stuff that the book Amy told us in this, you know, really great prose and it's really fascinating way that Rosamund Pike kind of brought in a totally different way through her performance.
Yeah, her work in all the scenes with Neil Patrick Harris, I think, is the best stuff in the movie. I think she's you get a lot of her panic and also contempt and also the way the gears are always sort of turning behind her eyes, waiting to like turn something to an advantage.
Right, and that, yeah, and feeling like, yeah, the sort of contempt for always being projected onto type of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, this is who you will be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing I did not like the first time that I actually responded to well the second time, oddly enough, was Rosamund Pike's performance in the first half of the movie. Because I felt there was this strange, like, if it was supposed to be such a happy marriage, then why does it all feel so, like, icy and stilted even at the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
But then the second time through, I thought, I really appreciated that it was so performative. Like,
yeah.
I noticed, like, some camera things, like, Fincher was doing. Like, the whole engagement scene at the press event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first time I saw it, I was like, oh my god, this is so affected. Mm-hmm. And the second time through, I was like, that is kind of perfect.
Yeah.
Because it's all sort of fantasy and all, like, performing a role.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all this, it's them, like, trotting out, like, movie rat-a-tat dialogue and not being that good at it and not feeling that authentic, which is so much what they're trying to say about early parts of a relationship and how you're trying to impress people.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a hard time reconciling her with any notion of the cool girl. Like, I do think there are things that they both perform in the ways you guys are talking about really interestingly, but I didn't see the good time gal that either Nick would want to hang out with or that she so memorably describes in that monologue, maybe because what you just said, Nathaniel, the sort of iciness of it the whole way through.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, where's the woman who would have been married to this guy who plays video games for even 5 minutes? Or
yeah.
Acted like she didn't care.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, yeah, I do think Fincher embraces chilliness more. I mean, surprise, surprise, Fincher likes people who are chilly. I think he definitely embraces that more in the character that is in the book, which does make the famous cool girl monologue stick out a little bit more than it would have.
I mean, I just rewatched The Game before I went and taught this, and watching Deborah Kerr Unger in that, I was like, oh, I get it. There's a type. Like, you're doing a Tim Burton thing. I understand. Okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, like, other Fincher women. I mean, would we throw Gwyneth Paltrow's character from Seven into that?
No, I think she's much warmer.
I think so, too.
But she's
only
so
that he can cut off her head.
Yeah, right.
But even that character is sort of, kind of isolates herself within her, like, sort of permanently teary, like, dissatisfaction with the city, and you can't really quite wrap onto why. I don't know. I went back to her a couple of times thinking about Gone Girl.
Well, I mean, some of his movies don't fit that well at all, but because The Girl with Dragon Tattoo, that fits, but I'm not sure Cate Blanchett and Benjamin Button or The Panic Room, or I think he has more variety than we're giving him credit for.
No, he does. This seemed like a, you know, something like an archetype that he's sort of interested in, not all the time, but
like serial killers.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I had like an overarching like resistance to the movie, it's that I do feel like it is so. And I understood that she took out a lot of plot elements that readers of the book miss, even if they understand why they're not there. But there's so much plot to cover, and the movie seems so kind of rushed at every single beat to include it all that I just feel like the whole thing sort of flies by. And at the level of momentum, that was kind of an impressive achievement that so many people who have said that's a longer movie than I usually like to sit through, and it didn't feel long.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of any kind of mental cat and mouse games or fleshing out relationships that wind up feeling a little bit rat-a-tat, I found it kind of disappointing, and sort of privileged the plot over some of the thematic elements or reverberations or psychological stuff that I thought could have been a lot more exciting and have been in some of his other movies.
Right, but they were just assuming that would come out in the editorials. Oh, they'll take care of that in post, in the papers and the blogs.
Yeah, they'll be writing about misogyny from here to Kingdom Come.
No, I mean, for example, the my favorite episode in the book is definitely Amy in the Ozarks. And I think it's such an interesting case of her making a mistake that's exactly the mistake she thinks other people make about her. Like, she totally underestimates the people that she's around. And I know that the movie wouldn't have the time to let that episode sort of draw out as long as it does in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But it does not feel at any point like Amy's not getting it, but there is a really interesting sort of mutual circling going on here until the very brief scene where they come in and sort of take her money. But otherwise, that woman especially is so kind of odious and picking wedgies and slurping on Mountain Dew and burping and just kind of being as kind of caricature-y as possible. And and I think that something, well, whatever. That was just an example of something that I thought could have been really psychologically tense and showed us something about Amy that was not in relationship to Nick. That mm-hmm. the movie just kind of turned into a plot turn.
That's a good point. I think that the claims about misogyny, I don't want to go too into it because I don't agree with that at all. But I think one of the things that's interesting about the movie is actually how many women are in it,
mm-hmm.
and how many different like types. Not everybody's fully fleshed out, but which rarely people are in huge ensemble casts. But there's a lot of different things going on with, you know, you have two different types of reporters. You have Kim Dickens, who I thought was great as the detective. And then the sister, like, I just found it very interesting. It was all these, even if a lot of them were in relation to Nick, there was enough going on that I felt like there was a lot of things to chew on. In addition to marriage, you know, as a theme.
I think all of those female characters really do a lot to, you know, whether or not it's successful, I think it does enough distancing to say, you know, Amy is not what we think all women are like. That is what this particular
right.
completely insane woman is like. And it's really important, and I think, you know, a less smart movie could have really not gone out of its way, but I agree that Kim Dickens is really great in it, and Carrie Coon too, and I think they do so much to just fill out this world that has a lot of women in it, like any other world, to constantly remind you that Amy is an exception, not the rule.
Mm-hmm. I read a really interesting piece, though, that all of the other women that are, like, sympathetic as opposed to Amy are taking on male characteristics, which I thought was an interesting point. Like Margot reading very sort of tomboy and Kim Dickens being very sort of the authority figure. The movie has a lot for people to editorialize, which of course is why it's had such a long shelf life in terms of conversation.
Yeah, it does feel like we're going to be talking about this forever.
It reminds me, though, a little bit of the Wolf of Wall Street conversation, where the dissent starts to get all lumped under one umbrella, where every sort of... I feel like this is a movie that does have some interesting things to say about gender, and it sort of bums me out that some of the dialogue about that sort of got swept under the rug of, like, well, they're calling it misogynist, and that's stupid.
Right.
Like, there were some people who were calling the movie misogynist, and that I don't think that is on point, but I feel like it gave a good excuse to people who didn't want to engage with that kind of dialogue at all. To just be like, oh, here's another one, Colin Gone Girl Misogynist. And like the Vulture article, and now I'm blanking on who wrote it, which talked about a little bit of what I was talking about how just the adaptation changes it from her story to almost entirely his story.
Mm-hmm.
Was interesting, and I felt like deserved a little bit more credit than maybe some were willing to give that.
Does the book, can I ask a question about the book really quick for those who've read it? Does the book wait as long as the movie does to introduce us to Amy's perspective?
It waits longer, actually.
Yeah, it waits longer, yeah. I think.
Oh, interesting.
It's pretty much the exact halfway point, right?
Yeah.
And I think it arrives a little bit earlier in the movie, proportionally. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it needed to, though. That change made sense to me.
Yeah. It does have a kind of, to me, maybe unfortunate compression effect on how... her own descriptions of watching what's happening to her marriage are really kind of poignant in the book, and they go through pretty subtle gradations. That's, I think, part of where Gillian Flynn's observational eye comes through the best, about understanding how two scenes that might seem kind of like similar infractions are not the same infraction in your relationship. And I think the movie has to speed through that so fast that it's like, we moved to Missouri, and all of a sudden he would stand on one side of the room, and I would be on this other side of the room. Okay.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
But I totally agree that, I mean, I get it, that you have to make tough choices, and it's better to get to Amy faster, even if it means you're going to be a little bit stuck.
Well, can I ask about Ben Affleck, actually, really quickly? I'm curious as to how other people sort of took in that performance, because I feel like one of the things that I was placated by when he was cast was that part of it was going to play into this idea that, like, Nick is the kind of person who people sort of instinctually gravitate towards not liking. And a lot of it is sort of the insincerity of that, the way that character sort of puts a happy face on things and becomes very kind of faux affable and in stressful situations and whatever. And I don't think Affleck puts that across as well as I would have liked him to.
I think
he just sort of like just settles on, I'm Ben Affleck a lot.
I actually thought the casting was brilliant there, because he is the type of actor that people love to project onto. You know, because people either have these, they already have so many conceptions about him. And I think Nick is the type of character that you're meant to understand has had a free pass and hasn't had to do anything other than be himself, be this, like, affable, like, somewhat charming, but also somewhat off-putting person. I just thought it was really super interesting casting. Like, I'm a little surprised that people have been negative about him, but I guess I shouldn't be, because they always are.
Yeah, it's the prophecy comes true. I thought one of the best line readings in the entire movie was when he's trying to solve the puzzle, and he's like reading these clues that she's left him, and he finds one, and he goes, oh, I know that one!
Right.
And he's so excited and so, like, eager to please the teacher, and it did feel so very Ben Affleck-y and so very this character. It was like, that was kind of like the moment I was waiting for in seeing him play this character and, like, getting across that desperateness to please.
So you're saying ultimately he was too good and he's fooling my censors.
Yeah, exactly. You're just having the Ben Affleck reaction, and you're not even seeing how genius he is.
I agree that his version, I agree with you, Joe, that his version of being charming does, I feel like, tend to involve a lot of waiting for you to come to him in a way, and not seeming that bothered if you don't, but, like, sort of strong silent type charming or something. Tim Robey had suggested that Bradley Cooper was who this movie really needed, and I think that's kind of genius. Like,
yeah, I kind of agree with that. Yeah.
He projects his own attempt, you know, his own charmingness, which people respond to really differently,
yes,
further outward.
Yeah. And
that was a little more of the idea I had about Nick. Whatever. Let's remake it. When we reboot it in 2015, or if we wait until 2016, we can try it.
We Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, just like everyone always wanted.
And like they get in every other movie. The Powell and Loy of the 2010s.
So how do we think it's going to do with Oscar?
I don't know.
It's a tough question, right?
Yeah.
I feel like I see it hanging in there, if only because we can't stop talking about it. Like, I think about how much air was breathed about Wolf of Wall Street that just kind of made it feel inevitable, even though I think, did it go on to win zero Oscars in the end? I can't remember. Yes. But I mean, I feel like it's got to get in there, and especially because there's no like blockbuster from the summer that makes sense in the slot. I feel like, you know, if you want a people's choice, which the Academy seems to do, that would make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's in its favor. I think the fact that they love Fincher is in its favor. I think I still would probably slot it in the bottom half of a top 10 at this point, just because I feel like and this is anecdotal and, you know, whatever, tenuous, but there was when I was at New York Film Festival screenings and I would sort of eavesdrop on people, I think there was a lot of sort of, oh, that was more of a popcorn movie than I thought it was going to be ultimately. And there's a snobbishness that can probably go against it in being grimy, little, unpleasant, you know, such and such. A film of the caliber of yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm. Of Benjamin Button.
Yeah.
Of Alien 3. I kind of think it might be one of those, maybe in editing, maybe in score, but I'm going to be surprised if it's much more than that.
I think Rosamund Pike.
I am also now obsessed after Katie's article with the wide openness of Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah.
Right?
With the right energy. I mean, I do feel like a lot of people have responded to Kim Dickens, especially, and she gets singled out a lot. I wonder if the movie needs to open a little bit later for something like that to be super possible. But Katie, it's all I think about now, even when I'm supposed to be paying attention to what people are talking to me about.
Well, after I had this one conversation about it, then I started getting, like, you get your hopes up because you're like, wait, what if that means there's room for this crazy person to get nominated?
No, totally.
And there's not, and you seem to stop killing yourself, but, you know.
That was me with supporting actors.
It's halfway wide open, because I think three slots are fairly well.
Right, but two slots is a lot when it's late in the year, you know.
Joe, who are the three you think are...
J.K. Simmons and Whiplash, Edward Norton and Birdman, Mark Ruffalo and Foxcatcher.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that, which is what I said, but otherwise anything could happen with the right campaign.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people who are well-liked or people liked the performance, but there's not that excitement around it. And and so there's the opportunity to build excitement around it if they campaign well.
Ethan Hawke. Sorry.
No, yeah, Ethan Hawke is definitely one. I keep waiting for someone to put together the Martin Short campaign for Inherent Vice. Yeah.
I mentioned that too, but as my horror if it happened in the article.
Have we heard anything about what the Selma plan is? The Selma plan sounds like a terrible, like, protocol for...
like, who they're going to campaign for
what?
Like
they talk about in Chuck and Buck? It's a secret movie.
It just feels like...
That's one of those ones that I was talking about that opens in January 16th, even though it has the Christmas
battle. The only time I ever remember that it's a thing is when I look at Oscar prediction charts.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same way with Unbroken, because both of them nobody's seen.
But Unbroken at least has trailers, two trailers now.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, there's no trailer for Selma, right? That's not just something I've missed.
Barely even any stills. There's like
Think I've seen any production stills or posters or like...
It's arguable they have not filmed it yet.
Right. Right. Like, at some point I'm waiting for Ava DuVernay just to be like, you know, we were just talking about this, right? Like, we haven't actually started.
No, there are a couple production stills, so I know that it happened.
It'd be amazing, just as a test, like a sort of catfish-style thing, to see if you could get the Academy to nominate a biopic that hadn't even actually been made.
It does feel completely possible.
You could certainly at least get it to Golden Globe nominations.
Yeah, as long as it stars a very famous person who will show up.
Like David Oyelowo.
Yes, the most famous actor in the world.
I also get really interested at these things, like the Gotham Award nominations came out this week, and A Most Violent Year got nominations. And I was like, so did they screen it only for the people who vote for this one specific award?
I guess.
And like, and nobody's been talking about, like, even like on Twitter or anything like that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it's like a thing like what Nick was talking about. When you're on a jury, you are supposed to keep things confidential if you're asked to.
Yeah, but that seems so less likely in the world that we live in.
Right, but there's only, if you think about it, there was only like 7 people on those juries.
I was going to say, like, if there's 7 people, you only need 4 to vote for you to get in, so I wonder if, like, that's what they screened it for.
Does it have a release date?
December 31st.
Okay.
Yeah.
December 42nd,
I think. Yeah. I mean, I 100% forgot that movie existed. Totally. Until it showed up on the Gotham list.
So well, the Gotham list actually pissed me off in that way, because the one that really upset me was still Alice. Because there's not even a guarantee that it will open in New York, and this is a New York award.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Because it's only announced that it's going to qualify for the Oscars, which is Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Like, it's not opening until January. So it seems, I don't know, it just seems incorrect to me to be like, even though I like the movie a lot and love the performance, it's like, I just don't think it's right.
Like, yeah, you know, really.
It might not even open in New York, and then you're giving it an award for a year which it didn't play in New York.
Yeah, they're not. They're kind of admitting their Oscar centricity and not as a New York award.
Right.
And it's too bad, because I was just having this argument with somebody about how, you know, well, the Gotham Awards don't matter. And it's like, well, the Gotham Awards matter to me because they don't matter. We're like, I kind of like the Gotham Awards and the fact that they'll, like, throw a nomination to somebody who won't see anything for the rest of the season. This could be the one nomination that Gugu Mbatha-Raw gets for Beyond the Lights.
Or Mia Vishnevetsky.
Yeah.
Did I tell you that the person who introduced Madame Bovary at the Toronto Film Festival, like, got weird with her last name in not exactly the Streep way, but, like, adjacent to the Streep way, and I was like, is there
one squeal of joy came from the back corner of the auditorium?
Honest to God, it was just like, who's that?
Yay!
That's weird. It doesn't seem like it should be that much of a stumbling block for people, even if you're doing the replacing the W's for V's thing. Like,
yeah, they totally changed the name. Starring Mia Wasikowska. And Joe's like, she doesn't even go here.
You're like, it's Saoirse Ronan. Stop it.
Oh, so Whiplash.
Yeah.
Yes.
I didn't like it, you guys, very much.
I don't think it's a very good movie, but it's one that I am warming to after I've gotten out of it, which is unusual for me.
It's being received as a very good movie, though, which makes me lean towards not liking it maybe more than I do. I thought it was a fairly...
You're the contrarian.
I know. We're learning terrible things about me today. I was immersed in it when I saw it, and then there were a couple points where my suspension of disbelief was stomped onto the ground and sort of had a symbol thrown at its head and was decapitated. And the ending, I thought, is preposterous, and that people are saying that the ending is the best part is sort of, it both makes sense, because, like, sometimes things that are preposterous go over very well. I think J.K. Simmons is great. I think the whole thing is the most boy of a movie that I've ever seen. It's just, it's so, like, adolescent boy cool, like, it's how like, awesome.
It starts to smell like boy, you know, like when you're in gym locker, it smells like that.
This movie taught me how hard it is to be a man with dreams.
And that is something that the Oscars never, ever understand.
No, it's really an underappreciated demographic.
Yeah.
The best possible thing happened, I might have already said this on the Toronto podcast, but I was waiting in line for this, and I was like 300th in the back, and the person next to me turned out to be a South Asian feminist experimental filmmaker.
Oh, nice.
Friends, and we were sitting on like the far aisle toward-ish the back of the theater, and like perfect person to watch Whiplash with. Like, we just thought things were funny. The rest of the audience was very concerned about, oh no, his blister has burst, and we like, ah ha ha! Like, look how hard he grips his drumstick. Oh, I see it. I think I even get the symbol.
Yeah, the thing that really broke it for me.
That's right. That's right, Katie.
I saw what you did there.
I just don't quite understand how we're supposed to buy that this guy, this teacher, who is so perfectionist and so much like, you're not going to fuck up my band, would to sabotage his own work just to show this punk kid a lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that to me, like, nothing of that holds together. And at some point, we're going to stop making sense and just let you know that everybody's crazy. And it's because we're relying on the fact that, like, oh, no, but he's nuts. He's just like, look at how crazy he is. And it's like, okay, well,
yeah,
I can check out of this now.
Well, it is my question about the movie that how you guys reacted to the question of how and to what extent the movie does gradually kind of let go of realism. And because I kind of watched the movie in a similar sense as what you're saying, Joe, of feeling like it just became so hyperbolic about both characters and their situations and their strategies. But even right around the time that there's that horrible car crash, it did seem like a lot of the enthusiastic writing it only by plausibility standards if the movie is showing me that it's not doing that anymore.
Right.
And not just about the characters, but even about what happened.
I mean, I considered that, but...
I mean, yeah, but it doesn't stylistically... I was thinking that too, but it's like it's sort of like a black swan thing. But yeah. Stylistically, it never pushes that envelope.
No. That's what I thought, but I was wondering if I had just not paid attention.
No, because everything in the imagery is so, like... I mean, you mentioned Black Swan, and actually that was the movie that I walked out of there thinking about, too.
Yeah.
Was, like, at least Black Swan had the courage of its goose flesh, basically. You know what I mean? Like, this one just kept going back to just these really, like, real bodily images. You know what I mean? They could, yeah. They're going to show his hands all that off. You know what I mean? It's like, you're not going that far afield. You're not really, you're not pushing it to the point where I can accept these insane implausibilities. You're still a character drama. And if you're still a character drama, I'm going to give a shit about the motivations of the characters.
Yeah, right? I mean, if you're going to go with like the bloody hands as symbol, I want, you know, Diane Ladd to do the makeup and I want them red, like everything red.
Right.
I love the idea of you being in a movie audience for any movie being like, I would like Diane Ladd to be doing this if you're going to do this.
And I mean, not to get ahead of ourselves or whatever, but like that's part of what makes me accept Birdman a lot more than Whiplash is like Birdman just goes there at least. And I can accept, you know, any number of implausibilities, including the fact that you don't turn right off the back of St. James to get to Times Square in your reach. So, but no, but I can like that's a movie that builds an infrastructure that totally allows you to disregard stuff like that. And I don't think Whiplash does. And I think it's relying on some disingenuous premises to try and if the filmmakers there are going to try and be like, oh, well, like it was heightened. And it's like, was it?
Yeah. And there's so many things that it does that are like typical narrative, like introducing a girlfriend at all just felt kind of exhausting and pointless.
So perfunctory. I was so...
Yeah, you have this girl who's there just to get ignored. It's exactly what you know is going to happen.
Yeah.
And it just felt like it had so many elements of that that when, you know, it was at the point where he got on stage and I was like, how could they rehearse this song that he doesn't know? And I just kind of, I got so frustrated with it.
Yeah.
But this movie has stuck with me in this way that I keep recommending it to people, even though it drove me crazy. Is anybody else doing this?
I mean, I would recommend it to people in that I know they would like it.
The one movie in this season of the year becomes you're like, oh, I just can't take it. And it is kind of, it's that for me right now. So
yeah.
I haven't.
Yeah, and yeah, good luck with that because I think Best Picture is happening.
No, I know.
And
I
think it's not going to win though, right?
No, but like, it'll get nominated.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think Chazelle is going to get nominated too.
I do too. I just updated my predictions and put him in there. I had some other point with Whiplash. Oh, I mean, maybe...
Is it about the tyrannical band leader who only cares about one person in the entire band?
No, but it was about... It was about the length. It felt to me, and Nick, I know this is a pet peeve of yours with a lot of movies, that the scenes were not taking me somewhere that the previous scene had not.
Mm-hmm.
So it just felt like, okay, so you're doing... what essentially your structure is here's scene one of Miles in his life, and here's scene two of Miles with this tyrannical mentor, and then the rest of the movie is going to be a repeat of both of those scenes, only each scene will escalate, but it will be the same scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like for me, for if you're gonna go over like 60 minutes, you can't just be doing the same scene over and over again. Like I got so frustrated with it. I was like, but I've already seen this.
Yeah.
But well, Nathaniel, repetition is what practicing the drums is all about.
And I think there's something about the ending. Like, I mean, the ending is, I think, beautifully shot, and I think the music is great, and it's very exciting. It kind of leaves you on this note of being like, yeah, which I think is a huge part of why it's taking off in this way. But there's a moment where he kind of fights back, where Miles Teller starts fighting back, and you see it as an actual battle of wills, which it hasn't been up to that point, where it's like, oh, That's what should have been going on this whole time. Like, that's a story, not just, like, repetition.
Mm.
And I don't know if that's part of what people are responding to, but I definitely got to that point, and I was like, all right, here's where you could have started being a really great movie if you only had gotten to this point, like, an hour ago.
Mm-hmm. I just think you could have the same movie, and it would be a lot better if it was just a half hour shorter. You know?
Yeah.
In that way, I think it's just one of those movies that's, it's just much too legible for what each moment is supposed to accomplish. Like, that scene, which to me kind of limits the actors a little bit, too, in what they can do. Like, the scene where J.K. Simmons has to have the obligatory, like, here's a moment where I get surprisingly sentimental,
mm-hmm.
Having convinced you all that I am a monster.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which not only felt like, I'd be surprised if most people in the audience didn't see coming the later reveal about that scene, but right. also that, like, just so perfunctory. Like, this is the thing I have to give the actor so that he can show, quote unquote, another facet of the character.
So he can get his Oscar clip.
Yeah, it just felt so. And, like, I don't think that the character that they leave him with, which is to be that repetitive tyrant over and over that Nathaniel's talking about, like, I don't think that's the hardest character type in the world to play. So I understand he makes a big impact, but I have a hard time seeing the great performance there.
Well, okay, so that was a lot today. Next week, Birdman?
Yeah.
Have you guys read Scott Tobias' review of Birdman, by the way, just to plant this for next week?
I have not, because I haven't seen it yet, but I will when I have.
I haven't seen it either, but if I can just read the first sentence to you.
Yeah, that's what I've read of it, is the first sentence.
Alejandro González Iñárritu is a pretentious fraud, but it's taken some time to understand the precise nature of his fraudulence. And then from there becomes one of the most, like, guns blazing, like, I didn't just hate this movie, I'm just fucking taking this guy down. Like, it's kind of incredible. I stopped reading it, too, because I haven't seen the movie, but Jesus.
Wow.
I'm excited for a movie that makes people that mad and also makes other people so euphoric.
Yeah. It's
it's divisive. Yeah.
Yep.
But it's one of the most essential movies of the year for that fact, I feel like.
Yeah, totally.
Well, that's
actually on a poster.
Yeah. Well, and actually that's you know what we were talking about with Gone Girl. It's like whether or not you like it, it feels like your year is not complete unless you have an opinion on it.
Yep, yeah. And how these movies cement themselves.
Right. All right, well, thanks again for joining me, Katie.
Thank you. I will see Birdman eventually. Stop yelling at me.
Joe Reed.
Thanks.
And Nick Davis.
I'm never going to see Birdman. I'm not going to take shit for it.
You do whatever Scott Tobias tells you to do.
That's right. Because he's my tyrant band leader.